This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. It's 6 in the morning on Friday, the 28th of January. I'm Shazana Mukhtar in studio today with Wong Xiaoning and Tan Chen Li.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's the last Friday before Chinese New Year, before the year of the tiger actually roars in. Can you imagine that?
We were looking for the pet tiger that we keep under our studio tables. He was just, you know, taking a bit of a nap. So we've woken him up. We are eagerly anticipating the year of the tiger. And in line with that, we do have a fun Friday lineup of stories and conversations, including a conversation with CLSA on their annual Feng Shui Index.
Yeah, we're going to speak to Worn Bearer, Justin Chan of CLSA, who's going to give us a view of this annual CLSA Feng Shui Index, which is a fun and tongue-in-cheek look at how the Hang Seng Index will perform, and maybe give you some tips depending on your zodiac sign in terms of your career, love, health, and wealth.
It started out as a funny Chinese New Year card back in the 1990s, yeah?
Yes.
But it's really progressed or developed as a staple of the company over the years because people just enjoy it so much.
Yeah, I mean, when I was a fund manager, we look forward to getting it usually maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks before Chinese New Year. And of course, in the old days, it used to come in a hard copy. And we would have a great laugh about it. And of course, you know, you look at your animal sign and think, okay, am I going to be rich this year? Is the god of fortune going to whisper in my ear? So we're going to ask Justin that, who's, by the way, day job is an analyst. He's the Hong Kong small and mid-cap analyst at CLSA.
But animal check. What animal zodiacs are you?
It's a secret.
Oh, is it?
It's not. I'm not. Guess what? I am.
Oh, you're the tiger. You're the tiger of the team.
Of course.
Sorry, that was Xiaoning growling all the time. Yes. Xiaoning's a tiger, I'm an ox, and Chen Li is a secret. But looking at other stories, we also have a fun one at 7:15.
7:15, we're talking about Malaysian fast food restaurants as they have been hit by chip shortage, and of course of the potato variety. We're not talking about chip semiconductor. So we'll be speaking to Stephen Saxon of McKinsey and Company for insights into the global supply chain disruptions.
And then later on at 7:45, we'll also be speaking to DAP Johor Chairman Liu Chin Tong on the party strategy ahead of the Johor state elections. So it's a packed show. All these conversations and more today, Friday the 28th of January. Keep it here, BFM 89.9. That was the Riverboat Song by Ocean Colour Scene. You're listening to The Morning Run with Shazana Xiaoning and Chen Li. Now, here's a fitting story to start the weekend. There's a labour movement that has been gaining traction. It's called the anti-work movement. What is this all about, Chen Li?
So during the period of pandemic, we have already spoken a lot about the Great Resignation, but there is a new movement now, which is called anti-work movement. So the movement, basically, they want to do away with the whole economic order that underpins the modern workplace and against jobs as they are structured under capitalism and also the state. And they believe that people should self-organize and labor only as much as needed. Rather than working long hours to create excess capitals or goods, they just want to work, do the necessary work and devote the rest of the time to family and personal passions and stuff like that.
Is that how you feel, Chen Li? Is that why you resonate with this story?
Not really. Although I did talk about it with my friends before, you know, wondering, is this really a capitalism thing? You know, maybe we should do away with it. It's just discussion.
I don't know. For me, y'all know I like to work, right? I have to confess, I do like my work. I don't have a very good work-life balance. I am driven by work. But I can see some parts of it resonating because if you've been, and especially in this COVID-19 era, okay, I think it really brings back to you what is important in terms of, is really how much money you make that important? Isn't your health, your wellness, your family, your friends much more important than anything else? And in life, have we kind of, in our goal to maybe accumulate goods, whether it's a new car, whether it's a new house, a new pair of shoes, a new handbag, you race out to basically make as much money as possible, and then you neglect the other parts of your life. And then maybe COVID-19 questions that balance or the lack of balance. So I think this article does resonate. And maybe, the younger generation also feel maybe there are much more important things in life.
Yes, I think so. But I also wonder if this is a privilege for those who can afford to do
this
option.
Yes, I think there is some truth to that.
Yes, yes.
And I think the anti-work movement, I mean, it feels to me, the explanation that you gave earlier about it being a response to capitalism, I think yes, but it's also expanded more broadly to become a debate on labor rights and the need to have better labor conditions for so many people working in the lower income segments especially. And I think this has taken root especially in the US because their labor conditions there can be quite terrible. They don't even have paid sick leave sometimes. The women don't get maternity leave.
Which I was so shocked. It's like one of the few, I think the only G7 country in the world, right, which doesn't mandate maternity leave. And hardly any companies offer any childcare facilities. And you're talking about what is still the richest country in the world, right? Why isn't this looked after?
So I'm not surprised at all that this debate has sprung up in the US in particular, just because of those disparities and really the lack of agency that a lot of laborers feel in the US. The anti-work movement, it really, the article says that it stems from a Reddit Reddit thread or a Reddit group. So they've really seen a subreddit. So they've really seen a lot of interest in this discussion. They've seen a lot of members come in. I think they're up to 1.7 million people who are following the discussions in anti-work right now.
Which includes one of our producers, Simwe Boon, who basically says that the conversation is rather interesting because I haven't been in, I'm not a member of this Reddit group, I'll confess. But for me, I think what is interesting is maybe that is also a resentment from people who currently, let's say you earn 3,000-4,000 ringgit, right? You just graduated from university. And you think to yourself, right, when am I ever going to save enough money to even buy my first car or my first property when the cost of living in Kuala Lumpur is so high? And 3,000 is actually pretty a nice number. I've heard of graduates earning much less than that. It's not a question of unemployment sometimes in Malaysia. It's underemployment. And you tell people, oh, if you do A, B, C, D, you can achieve your goals. But it's not true, right? So that resentment builds. And then you think to yourself, well, I'll just not work then. What's the point? Because I can't get what I want eventually anyway.
I feel like the not working part is...
It's a privilege, though.
It's a privilege. Mm-hmm. And yes, it's a privilege. It's a minority.
It doesn't apply to anyone.
It doesn't apply to the vast majority who understand that they need to earn income to put food on the table. But it's an interesting discussion that's taking place in the internet universe and beyond. Tell us what you think. Do you see an anti-work movement rising in Malaysia? What do you think are the... what are the interesting threads of discussion coming out of this movement? You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We're taking a short break, and after that, we'll come back with a look at Transparency International's Annual Corruption Index. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. That was Fleetwood Mac with Say You Love Me. We love Fridays. It's the morning run with Shazana Shaoning and Chen Li. Now, we're turning our attention to Transparency International's latest Corruption Perception Index that was released this week. We did discuss Malaysia's drop in the rankings to number 62 with Transparency International Malaysia President Dr. Muhammad Mohan earlier this week. You can look up that podcast on the BFM app. This morning, we're also taking a look at broader trends drawn from the Corruption Perception Index findings as covered in The Economist.
So most of the world scores poorly in the Transparency International Annual Corruption Index. In the latest ranking released on January 25th, with 100 indicating a squeaky clean record, and almost 70% of the countries scored below 50. But poor countries seem to do a little bit worse than rich ones, partly because poverty makes corruption worse and partly because corruption makes poverty worse. But the average score in sub-Saharan Africa is 33, the lowest for any region. And then in Western Europe, it is 66. America dropped out of the 25, which is the least corrupt countries for the first time.
So in a way, the headline is a little bit misleading, right? They say corruption is getting worse in many poor countries, but hey, corruption's getting worse in rich countries too.
Yeah, so exactly. But there's a little byline, you know, in The Economist. You see the title, right? So in big font, corruption is getting worse in many poor countries. Then there's in a smaller font, but rich countries have problems too.
So the headline should be all countries are getting worse.
Exactly. Yes.
Which country is getting better? Please tell us some good news, right?
That would be nice to have a little bit of a pick me up in the story.
Maybe a few years later, because apparently for you to once you drop a few points, and it's very hard for you to gain those points back. So it's not easy to move higher in the ranking.
I mean, we can see that very clearly with our case, right? And the article did point that out, that a lot of the times moving up the ranks is very much dependent on regime change. So they tend to see these big jumps when there has been a change of government or I suppose a change of direction in the country's leadership overall. Then that tends to lend itself to going up in the rankings. But similarly, as we see in Malaysia, we've had multiple changes of government.
Yeah. We've had three in 2 years, am I correct?
That's right.
And that has seen a corresponding effect to our rankings, which has dropped. One reason could be because the government has taken its eye off the anti-corruption ball because they're too busy politicking at the top, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe. Just to kind of crystallize that thought, Shaz, if you look at Malaysia's score, so there's a difference, right? There's a ranking. So the ranking should be the lower the number, the better. But when it comes to score, the higher the number, the better. So Dr. Muhammad Mohan in our call said, you know, in an ideal scenario, we should be ranked 30 plus, and our score should be above 60. But currently what it is that we our score is 48, and we were at 51 in 2020, and then we were at 53 at 2019. Now, what worries me is the economist in this article says that in a normal scenario, it shouldn't be the case where you drop more than a point every 1 or 2 years. But we seem to be dropping quite a bit every year. And what does this mean? Does it mean that, you know, it's downhill all the way? And I think the critical question every poor country or rich country needs to ask itself is, how do we get back up? How do we improve our score and improve the rankings? And what needs to change for that to happen?
Actually, a lot needs to be done. For example, why, I think Dr. Mohan actually mentioned also why exactly our scores dropped so much. There's a string of issues that our country had. One, of course, there has been no progress on reforms to the MACC. Then there's also on the Whistleblower Protection Act that he mentioned, amongst other things. There's actually quite a few things that he mentioned before. So it's something to look at. Actually.
That's right. He did also point out that we do have a national anti-corruption plan. We have a blueprint in place. You know, we love our blueprints.
Yes.
So maybe we should work to implement the plan that was put in place in 2019, I believe.
Yeah.
So I think that's worth looking into. And if you look at just globally, just the broader trend, I think the fact that the pandemic has put a lot of economic pressures on countries, it's created an environment where corruption could take place more frequently, perhaps, and with less monitoring, simply because everyone's being distracted by other pressing issues as well.
Yeah, that's actually a very valid point. In the sense that, you know, the last 2 years, what has every government's priority been? It is clearly COVID-19 and the healthcare system. So even the watchdogs, you know, are distracted by what's going on in their own country. So on one hand, governments are busy doing this. On the other hand, the people that normally keep an eye on this are also prevented from monitoring things on the ground because borders are closed, right? There is movement restriction. Even until today, I mean, like, let's say for myself, if I wanted to go to another country, it's not as easy in the old days, right? You could just book a ticket, get on a plane, and before you knew you were there. So all these watchdogs, their monitoring process is hindered. Now, what does this then mean, you know? What are the consequences of increasing corruption? And I worry because it's a cycle, right? So your people feel poor or your officials feel poor. And what they do is that, you know, naturally, you're a human being, you're more tempted. And then you create a greater disparity once again, right?
I want to draw your attention to a very interesting point that Dr. Mohan made during the launching of the Transparency International Malaysia's findings. He pointed out that a lot of the countries who ranked lower in the CPI, they also tended to have lower health sector investment, which he says could be because funds were being siphoned off due to corruption. Hence, they had less money to actually invest in healthcare. And I thought that, wow, that was such an interesting point to make in the sense that it's true. And when you look at how much we suffered during the pandemic because of low healthcare investment, I mean, that's just one of very many reasons why we really need to deal with corruption seriously.
Yeah. But I want to call out the rich countries too, right? And the way they do it sometimes is just a little bit more sophisticated, maybe not so obvious, but it does happen. And I think UK is a classic example of this, where Owen Paterson, a former British MP, resigned after becoming embroiled in a lobbying scandal because he accepted $500,000 on top of his salary for consulting work. And even Bojo is being investigated for the fact that his apartments at 10 Downing Street, the renovation, the wallpaper, which apparently cost £50,000 was paid for by a Conservative Party donor. Isn't that a form of corruption?
Absolutely. It happens everywhere, and it's important to have these checks and balances in place so that everything can be monitored at all levels. So tell us what you think. How would we improve our anti-corruption efforts? How can we improve our ranking in the CPI? You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. We're heading into the 6:30 a.m. news bulletin. Taking us there is Shout to the Top by the Style Council, BFM 89.9. That was Lord with Royals, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Shazana Shaoning and Chen Li, Friday the 28th of January. It's that time of the morning where we cast our eyes across the horizon to look at all the different stories that are coming out in global newspapers and portals. What do you have in front of you? Who'd like to start?
Well, I'll start with a bit of good news. If you are an F1 fan, remember that? Once upon a time, cars used to go whizzing by a track. Well, they're going to go whizzing by in Singapore because the Singapore Tourism Board and promoters of Singapore GP announced a new 7-year deal to continue hosting the Formula One race there. And I think it's going to start on October 12th.
I think this is one of the longest deals that has been made so far. And Formula One has really, for me at least, I think it's getting a kind of renaissance following the Netflix series Drive to Survive. I think this generated a lot
that,
of... I'm a second-hand watcher.
You like speed? I'm shocked.
I talk to other people who enjoy watching it, so I get all my details from them.
I've seen you drive, and I wouldn't say you're like a super-duper fast driver.
I agree.
I am probably not. I'm not a super-duper fast driver.
And I won't out you as to what car you drive, but it doesn't go that fast.
No, it doesn't. But what I'm talking about is that this series, Drive to Survive, has really managed to capture the drama behind the scenes at Formula One races. And it's garnered a whole new generation of supporters for F1. So I think this is quite a lucrative move to keep F1 in Singapore for a longer period of time, especially as things heat up. The last season was very, very tight between the two top contenders. So I'm not surprised I'm not surprised that they took this move.
I didn't know you're a big fan of F1.
Like I said, I'm a secondhand follower, so I talk to people who do follow, and hence I absorb everything by osmosis.
Okay, but I think what is Singapore's trying to do here is to signal that, hey, we're back. We're back in action. International travellers, please come in. It's safe to travel despite COVID-19, and we have to get back on our feet, because F1 actually had been cancelled for the last 2 years. And to be fair to them, they do put on a really good show. I mean, it's a street race. It's in the evening, and they always have the best performers. I think 1 year they had like Jay Chow. I can't even remember who else performed. But I think they'll probably try and do the same thing here and revive their tourism. That's, right. I think, the key purpose of this.
Yeah, I agree. I think everyone's trying to gear up and try to welcome those visitors back. What else has caught your eye in international headlines?
For me, I was looking at Blackstone, who's actually on the lookout for more opportunities they're trying to buy more assets and stuff like that because of the very good stock market so far right now for them, especially, particularly the hard hit sectors such as e-commerce, cloud computing and cybersecurity. Blackstone actually has very interesting numbers. They drew $154 billion in new assets during the fourth quarter, a split between organic inflows and also closing of new insurance accounts. So they have been attracting a lot of insurance-related investment strategies who's actually seeking yield together with the wealthy investors as well. They actually account for 40% of overall assets. They announced that they're going to raise 17 new funds targeting $150 billion in new assets. And then last quarter, they also sold assets worth of $21 billion. So there's quite a lot of interesting action happening in the PE sector, which I think they're looking at the technology side of things because it's a cheap buy right now.
Are we going to see any of that come to Asia? Any of that interest come to Asia? Does Blackstone have any investments here that are worth watching or, worth keeping an eye on?
So far,
not that I can remember at the top of my head. Carlyle Group, KKR, they're in the region, but less so in Malaysia partially because these guys, their fund size is so huge that when they look at deals, right?
The ticket size needs to be big as well.
And so far, our ticket size for our deals are quite small. So not yet, but maybe who knows? Yeah.
Who knows?
Okay, yes. So a look at the PE deal-making space there. Any other headlines that have caught your eye this morning?
I have one which is related to human rights and also then related to the Olympics, because the South China Morning Post has reported that China says UN human rights chief can visit Xinjiang after the Olympics.
Well, finally, I feel like it's been a long time. This has been asked for a very, very long time. UN rights monitors have asked China time and time again to allow them to visit the Xinjiang province to see what's actually happening there. The fact that China has given their indication that they will allow human rights monitors at last is positive.
It is. And you're right, they have been negotiating, UN's top human rights officials have been negotiating for this with Beijing since September 2018. This is on the back of allegations that there's as many, and it's not even allegations, I think, because the BBC did some very good reporting on it, that there are up to maybe 1 million Uyghurs that are being held in mass detention camps. So I think it's a good step forward.
These are allegations, these are serious allegations being made against China, and I do hope that we actually have proper transparency into what's going on. You know, we'll be watching this space very closely. It's 6:45 in the morning. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll rifle through the local newspapers and click through the local news portals to tell you what's top stories making news in the morning. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. That was The Kinks with Better Things. I hope that's a prescient statement that tomorrow, Saturday, we'll all find better things. It is the start of the weekend. You are listening to The Morning Run with Shazana Xiaoning and Chen Li. Now, it's that time of day where we take a look at what's making headlines in our local newspapers and portals. Who'd like to start us off?
Well, I'll start with the Edge CEO morning brief that has confirmed that Maybank has found its new chief, which I think everybody was half expecting anyway. And it is going to be the current, well, he's leaving, the CEO of RHB Bank. So the new Maybank head will be Dato' Khairul Salim Ramli, excuse me. He was actually from Maybank once upon a time. He was actually their CFO. But of course, then this begs the question, who's going to be the new RHB CEO? Is there going to be musical chairs in the banking space?
I think back in 2013, Dato' Khairul Salim also was a contender to be the Maybank replacement CEO. That's when Tan Sri Abdul Wahid was leaving then. So I think this is very interesting because there's quite a lot of heads being changed around right now in the banking industry.
And another one that's actually retiring, a very, very, very experienced longtime banker, is Tan Sri Azman Hashim. He's going to retire as AMMB's non-independent, non-executive chairman effective 31st of March. He took over this bank, brought it up to be one of the leading investment banks in Malaysia. And finally, he's retiring. He's going to take over a new role as Emeritus Honorary Advisor at some of these different institutions instead.
All right, so a lot of changes in the banking space there. If we still stick to the Edge CEO morning brief, there are a couple of headlines on page 2 that I thought were quite worthy of note. Firstly is regarding COVID-19 vaccination for children. It's set to begin on February the 3rd, and the Health Ministry has previewed parents to start looking at their MySejahtera app in the Klang Valley soon. They'll be able to make appointments for their children, and this facility will be rolled out throughout the country eventually. But something to look forward to, February 3rd is, after all, next week.
Yeah, and actually started yesterday, you can actually get your booster shots for adults. You can just walk into any of the 4 PPVs to get it done. Looks like the government is really accelerating its vaccination program across the board for all ages, no longer having any restrictions. Now, staying on the banking scene very quickly, Affin Banks is going to apparently sell its asset management arm to CVC Capital Partners, and hey, that's a PE fund, for over 2 billion ringgit.
CVC again. And moving into the also banking and a little bit of politics here, which is Genting, Hong Kong. We were talking about this morning. So basically, Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim demands the finance ministry for explanation on how Genting, Hong Kong is able to get unsecured loans worth 2.5 billion from the banks. So the three banks that was in question is Maybank, CIMB and RHB. And basically, all the banks actually came out and say that, no, this doesn't really hurt my books. So Maybank came out and say that this allegation is baseless. RHB say that they are financially resilient with strong capital and liquidity position. CIMB came out and say that we are not able to disclose or comment on specific names or clients.
Well, we'll see, honestly, we'll see very soon what kind of impairment, if at all, these three banks will be making with regards to this loan, right, this unsecured loan. And that will be coming up in the next quarter, I think, easily.
So I'm going to wrestle the space from banking and coming back to health, because that's what I'm looking at this morning. If we stick to the healthcare headlines, Malaysia plans to outlaw the sale of tobacco products to those born after 2005. So that was an announcement made by the Health Minister Khairi Jamaluddin just yesterday. And I think this is a pretty remarkable policy forward. I think not too long ago, last month, New Zealand also announced an intention to ban the sale of tobacco products to anyone born after 2008. They're planning to implement a similar law. So I guess, is this the start of a trend that we're going to see tobacco products being outlawed moving forward? I mean, I think it's something very interesting to watch. And in fact, if you have some time, you should check out a podcast on our BFM app by the Bigger Picture team. I believe they just had this discussion on health and living, on how we should deal with tobacco and smoking and the like of those issues.
Yeah, very interesting. Of course, I'm sure people will argue, doesn't this go against my civil liberties, by the way? I just want to be a bit of a dampener for those who are travelling today, because I think there will be definitely a lot of outflow out of KL. Everybody, balik kampung. Please stay safe, because Omicron virus is here, and that has already been warned by our Ministry of Health.
And our numbers yesterday passed 5,000.
So please keep to your SOPs.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.